content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media. The Triangle Radio Reading Service would like to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we are reading this week from the February 3rd, 2017 issue of The Week magazine, the main stories and how they were covered. President Trump makes his mark. What happened? Donald Trump launched his presidency with a flurry of executive action, pulling the U.S. out of a major trade agreement, ordering the construction of the Mexican border wall, and beginning the process of dismantling the Affordable Care Act. After the new president was sworn into office last Friday, his first full day in charge was marred by massive protests against his administration and his angry reaction to media reports about the modest size of his inauguration crowd. But Trump wasted little time in wielding his executive pen. He pulled the U.S. out of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, TPP, a 12-nation trade deal negotiated by the Obama administration that hadn't been ratified by Congress, and scheduled meetings with the premiers of Canada and Mexico to begin renegotiating the North American Free Trade Agreement. He directed the Department of Homeland Security to begin constructing a border wall and to strip funding for so-called sanctuary cities, which refused to hand over undocumented immigrants to federal authorities. Beginning today, the United States of America gets back control of its borders, Trump said. In other executive orders, Trump directed federal agencies to waive, defer, grant exemptions, or delay any parts of the Affordable Care Act that it deems burdensome, cleared the way for the approval of the controversial Keystone XL and Dakota Access oil pipelines, which had been halted amid environmental concerns, reinstated the so-called Mexico City policy, which prevents American foreign aid from going to organizations that offer women advice on abortion, and implemented a hiring freeze on all federal government workers except military personnel. His administration also instructed the Environmental Protection Agency to freeze all its grants and contracts. He was expected to issue another executive order temporarily banning refugees and immigrants from Syria, Iraq, Iran, Libya, Somalia, Sudan, and Yemen. After repeating his unsubstantiated claim that millions of people voted illegally in November's election, the president said he'd launch a major investigation into the issue. Depending on the results, he tweeted, "We will strengthen up voting procedures." What the editorial said. Withdrawing from the TPP may end up benefiting a sliver of U.S. manufacturing workers, said USA Today. But the trade agreement was America's best hope for expanding its influence in Asia and limiting the influence of China, which is not part of the deal. Without the U.S., the TPP's remaining 11 nations will likely join a rival trade group that puts China at its center. Right from the start, our new president is doing what he promised, said the Chicago Tribune, focusing on creating jobs and boosting wages. The former businessman told a group of CEOs in the White House that he wants to reduce the top corporate tax rate from 35% to 15 or 20%, and to reduce business regulations by 75%. Those are the kinds of moves that encourage companies to invest more and add jobs. After the anemic economic growth that followed the Great Recession of 2008, President Trump's efforts to spur business activity are very welcome. What the columnist said. During the election, journalists were mocked for taking Trump literally, not seriously, said Jamel Bowie in Slate.com. Trump wouldn't literally build a wall or ban Muslims from entering the U.S., we were told. Those were statements of concern rather than guides to action. Now we know Trump really does think voter fraud is widespread. He genuinely intends to build a wall and to block immigration and visitors from many Muslim-majority countries. His divisive campaign was not an act. From a policy stance, the Trump presidency is actually off to a surprisingly effective start, said David Graham in TheAtlantic.com. The leaders of both Canada and Mexico have signaled they're willing to open negotiations on NAFTA. And after meeting with Trump, labor leaders praised his efforts to keep companies from sending jobs abroad. Republican lawmakers show little interest in investigating his conflicts of interest. Despite the bad optics of his tweeting and his feud with the press, this is a presidency moving forward on many of its key goals. But this is the easy part, said Peter Winter in the New York Times. What happens when hard times hit, when crises arise, when other politicians and world leaders do not bend to his will? If past is prologue, Trump will create enemies, the press, other nations, even Republican leaders, and do everything in his power to delegitimize and destroy them. A narcissist with illiberal tendencies, a volatile personality, and no internal checks now controls the awesome power of the presidency. It's hard to see this ending well. Trump's presidency will be a fascinating test of how strong American institutions are, said Francis Fukuyama in Politico.com. Trump will routinely flout norms, lie egregiously, and attack institutions like the intelligence community and the Federal Reserve. But his authoritarian governing style and extreme domestic and foreign policy stances will eventually meet resistance from small government conservatives in Congress, the judiciary, his own cabinet, and the blue states. In the end, all of these checks will operate to constrain Trump. Or so I hope. And a short, it wasn't all bad item while we're on this page. A four-year-old bookworm's dreams came true this month when she was named guest librarian for a day at Washington's Library of Congress. Dahlia Marie Arana of Gainesville, Georgia, read her first book on her own at 2 years and 11 months and has since plowed through more than 1,000 titles. When her mother reached out to the Library of Congress to request a visit, the institution's head, Carla Hayden, invited Dahlia to shadow her for a day. It was an experience Dahlia will never forget, said Mom Halima Arana. She just kept saying how the Library of Congress is her most favorite library in the whole world. And our controversy of the week, alternative facts. Is Trump at war with reality? The first task of every autocrat is to delegitimize facts, said Ezra Klein in Vox.com. And President Trump is off to a flying start. On his first full day in office, Trump sent an irate press secretary, Sean Spicer, to dress down the White House press corps and proclaim it was shameful and wrong of the press to have shown photos suggesting that the crowd at Trump's inauguration was two or three times smaller than the one at President Obama's in 2008. Spicer insisted, using a slew of easily disproved claims, that Trump's had been the largest audience to ever witness an inauguration, period. In a rambling, self-aggrandizing speech at CIA headquarters that same day, Trump also insisted the media had lied about his crowd size and had invented his blistering criticisms of the intelligence services, criticisms that could still be found on Trump's Twitter feed. The most chilling soundbite came from Trump's advisor, Kellyanne Conway, who on Meet the Press used the Orwellian phrase, alternative facts, to characterize Spicer's blatant falsehoods. This is not a conventional dispute over facts, said Greg Sargent in WashingtonPost.com. Trump is trying to discredit not only the press's critical role in our democracy, but also the idea of factual reality itself. For at least the next four terrifying years, the truth is what Donald Trump says it is. The president must be held accountable for his falsehoods, said David French in NationalReview.com. But those with no credibility make poor critics. The same reporters, now apoplectic over Trump, happily swallowed the Obama administration's serial deceptions for 8 years. On Obamacare, Benghazi, the IRS investigation of Tea Party groups. Worse, said Sean Davis in TheFederalist.com, Trump had barely been sworn in before mainstream outlets were circulating lies of their own, including that he removed a bust of Martin Luther King Jr. from the Oval Office and blew a kiss at and hugged FBI Director James Comey at a meeting. It was actually a handshake and arm pat. This nation desperately needs a source of unbiased, credible information. But based on the media's overt hostility to Trump, that institution does not currently exist. The reporter who made the mistake about the King bust issued a correction and an apology, said Jennifer Rubin in WashingtonPost.com. Compare that with President Trump, who this week yet again insisted on the dangerous falsehood that up to 5 million illegal immigrants voted for Hillary Clinton in November. Clearly, Trump cannot help himself. He lies because reality won't conform to his narcissistic view of the world. Trump's insecurity-driven war with math goes back to his days as a TV star, said James Poniewozik in NYTimes.com, when he would insist The Apprentice was the number one show on television, even though ratings showed it was the 67th. The fact that he lost the popular vote to Clinton by nearly 3 million votes rankles him deeply, as did the fact that his inaugural crowd was smaller than both Obama's turnout and the Women's March. These facts can't be true and must be denied because Donald J. Trump is not a loser. The press faces a real danger here, says Ross Douthat in the New York Times. It serves Trump's interest to portray his disregard for facts as a partisan war with the press, and he has a gift for dragging his opponents down to his level of venom and hyperbole. If the president provokes journalists into a kind of hysterical oppositionalism, a mirroring of Trump's own tabloid style, they will delegitimize themselves and do the demagogue's work for him. It was a good week for the power of belief. After a national pizza chain, Villa Italian Kitchen introduced an alternative facts pizza, a presidential pie topped with bacon, pepperoni, ham, sausage, homemade sauce, and wholemeal mozzarella that will have 0 calories. It was a good week for having a strong right. After Fox Business correspondent Charles Gasparino reported seeing White House advisor Kellyanne Conway throw some mean punches in a man's face while breaking up a fight during Trump's inaugural ball. Now I know why Trump hired her, Gasparino said. And it was a good week for Fido. After a new amendment to Alaska's divorce law empowers judges to assign joint custody of pets and requires courts to take into consideration the well-being of the animal. But it was a bad week for mixing politics with work after the Secret Service said it would take disciplinary action against a female agent who said in a Facebook post she'd rather go to jail than take a bullet for Donald Trump. It was a bad week for road trips after researchers found that jet lag hurts the performance of Major League Baseball players, lowering batting averages and leading to pitchers giving up more home runs, especially when players travel west to east across two or more time zones. And it was a bad week for naming rights after a Vancouver Buildings Council blocked the lease of a restaurant property to the fish and chips chain Moby Dick's on the ground that dick is an offensive word. The property owners argue that the name has literary significance and does not refer to male genitalia. And before we move on from here, a boring but important item, a replacement for Obamacare. Two Republican senators this week unveiled an alternative to the Affordable Care Act that would give states the option to keep most of the law's major provisions. Senators Bill Cassidy of Louisiana and Susan Collins of Maine introduced the legislation amid mounting pressure on the GOP to propose a replacement for the law before repealing it. Their bill would allow states that chose to stick with Obamacare to continue to impose the individual mandate, expand Medicaid, and provide coverage to those with pre-existing conditions. States that opted out would be required to provide market-based alternatives, like auto-enrolling the uninsured into catastrophic plans. Democrats said the bill was too vague and could cause millions of people to lose their insurance. We're on the briefing page now. Israel's growing settlements. The Trump administration supports Israel's West Bank expansion, but most of the world does not. What happens now? How many settlements are there? More than 100 settlements now dot the hilly landscape of the West Bank, a 2,100-square-mile area west of the Jordan River that, in theory, will someday become the heart of a Palestinian state. The international community considers those Jewish settlements illegal, or in the U.S. government's case, illegitimate. That's because Israel occupied the West Bank and East Jerusalem after winning the 1967 Six-Day War, and the Geneva Conventions prohibit settling people on the territory of another nation, one in war. Yet under Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu, the settler population has ballooned by 100,000 people over the past 8 years to a total of 570,000 settlers. As a parting protest against that policy, the outgoing Obama administration in December withheld its veto and allowed a UN Security Council resolution to condemn the settlements. Israel's construction work has created a sense of urgency and panic, says Arab-Israeli negotiator Aaron David Miller. What do these settlements consist of? Some, such as Ariel, are sprawling developments of stone apartment blocks housing 20,000 people, along with synagogues, shopping centers, schools, and a university. In addition to these approved settlements are another 100 or so unapproved outposts. These isolated camps are usually located deeper into the West Bank, sometimes closer to the Jordan than Israel, and are often established by the most politically radical or ultra-Orthodox Jews who arrive with tents and trailers. Life in and around the settlements can be tense and violent for both Palestinians and Jews. Why are they being built? The Israeli government says it's the result of natural growth of its tiny, crowded nation. About 80% of the settlers live near the pre-1967 Green Line separating Israel and the West Bank. Israeli officials say these settlers can be incorporated into Israel in a future peace deal through land swaps. But many Jewish settlers, particularly those in the more isolated outposts, believe that they have a religious and historical claim on the land, which they call by the biblical name Judea and Samaria. These settlers have created facts on the ground that would make a two-state solution more difficult, if not impossible. How are they going to evacuate all of us, says settler leader Davidi Pearl. We are winning. As the settler population has grown, so has the popularity of pro-settler political parties such as Jewish Home, forcing Netanyahu to the right. Is a two-state solution still viable? It seems increasingly unlikely. Even with a map change, the government would have to find a way to evacuate and relocate the more than 80,000 people in more isolated settlements and outposts, many of whom have pledged to fight to defend their homes. Netanyahu and many Israelis say Palestinians have only themselves to blame for the situation and for the failure of the peace process. They point out that in 2008, Palestinian leaders flatly turned down a peace proposal in which Israel offered to withdraw from 93% of the West Bank, compensating Palestinians with land from the Negev. And when Netanyahu agreed to Obama's demand for a 10-month settlement freeze in 2009, Palestinian leaders refused to attend peace talks. The real obstacle for a two-state solution isn't the settlements, Netanyahu said in a response to the UN resolution, but the ongoing Palestinian refusal to recognize Israel as the state for the Jewish people in any borders. What happens without a two-state solution? In a fiery exit speech, outgoing Secretary of State John Kerry in December warned Israel that it was heading toward a stark choice between being Jewish or democratic. If Israel embraces the perpetual occupation of a one-state future, said Kerry, it will have to deny full political rights to its rapidly growing Palestinian population. In that scenario, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict will grow ever more bitter and violent, and Israel will become a pariah nation that's never at peace. What effect will President Trump have? Trump condemned the UN resolution against the settlements, and with opposition from the U.S. removed, the building of settlements will increase. Netanyahu this week announced approval of 2,500 new units in the West Bank. And since Trump's victory, the number of planning approvals for housing in East Jerusalem has quadrupled. Trump has also promised to recognize Jerusalem as Israel's capital and to move the U.S. embassy there from Tel Aviv, a move Palestinian leaders warn will spark another violent intifada. Trump's choice for U.S. ambassador to Israel is bankruptcy lawyer David Friedman, who has helped raise millions of dollars for settlements and calls the two-state solution an illusion. Trump, however, says that he plans to send his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, to the region to negotiate a peace deal. All my life, I've been hearing that's the toughest deal in the world to make, Trump said. But I have a feeling that Jared's going to do a great job. Life in the settlements. In some areas of the West Bank, like parts of the Gush Etzion block, things are relatively peaceful. Arabs and Jews walk together, shop together, and work alongside one another at the local supermarket. In other settlements, life couldn't be more different. Security is tight, and areas are segregated into heavily militarized Jewish and Arab zones. Violence regularly breaks out on both sides. In the most radical Jewish outposts, armed militant settlers have been accused of intimidating Palestinians, poisoning their crops, and uprooting their olive trees. In the past year, Palestinians launched what some call the Knife Intifada, with militants, some of them teenagers, stabbing more than 200 Israeli soldiers and civilians. Whenever you are on the road, you're worrying if somebody is going to lay ambush to you or throw stones or worse, said Chaim Silberstein, a resident of the Beit El settlement. But Silberstein and his family refused to leave, saying the Jewish people have a history there going back 4,000 years. It's an amazing feeling that you are connected to the deepest roots of your nation, of your land, he says. On the best columns, we'll take first one from the U.S. Extreme wealth is not obscene. The world's eight richest men own as much wealth as the world's poorest 3.7 billion people, half the planet's population, said Jeff Jacoby. That's what the international charity Oxfam tells us, calling it a vast income gap, a moral and social calamity. It's a striking statistic, but it's also irrelevant. To begin with, the Oxfam Eight, Microsoft's Bill Gates, investor Warren Buffett, telecom mogul Carlos Slim Helou, Facebook's Mark Zuckerberg, clothing magnate Amancio Ortega, Amazon creator Jeff Bezos, Oracle co-founder Larry Ellison, and New York City's entrepreneur ex-mayor Michael Bloomberg aren't parasites exploiting the masses. Through hard work and ingenuity, they've created enterprises that improve the lives of billions. Moreover, each gives massive amounts to charity. Meanwhile, thanks to capitalism, the world's poor have been climbing out of poverty at the fastest rate in human history. Over the past 30 years, the number of people in extreme poverty has dropped by 75%, or 1.2 billion people. Liberals keep insisting that extreme wealth is obscene, and if the economy were a zero-sum game in which people get richer only if poor people get poorer, that's not true. Wealth is good, and the more people who can create and earn it, the better. From Romania, corrupt politicians get a holiday. Romania's new leaders have come up with a self-serving way to solve prison overcrowding, said Horia Bledaru. Build more prisons? Nope. Just pardon all the corrupt politicians. The Social Democratic-led government, which took office in December, has announced its intent to pardon certain white-collar convictions if the sentence was less than 5 years and to decriminalize abuses of power that cause less than $50,000 in damage to the budget. The maximum penalty for abuse of office will also be reduced from 7 years in prison to three. Of all the problems facing the country, this was the Social Democrats' top priority. Of course, what should we expect from a party led by a criminal? Social Democrat Chairman Livio Dragnea was barred from becoming prime minister because of an electoral fraud conviction, but he is still running things behind the scenes. Dragnea and his party have no compunction or hesitation about sweeping aside any rule that prevents them from plundering the state. These rascals must be stopped. Romania, once a communist dictatorship and then ravaged by greedy oligarchs, has made great strides toward judicial fairness in the past few years. We the people cannot let our leaders trample the rule of law. Only the direct involvement of citizens can save reforms and halt this deeply pernicious political agenda. And on the international page, one of the How They See Us articles, China picks up free trade mantle. President Trump has all but declared a trade war with China, said the South China Morning Post in an editorial. His inaugural address was unprecedented in its angry tone and themes of nationalism, isolationism, and protectionism. Trump didn't mention China in the speech, but his past remarks about currency manipulation and unfair trade deals echoed when he vowed to protect the U.S. from the ravages of other countries making our products, stealing our companies, and destroying our jobs. To him, trade with China, with Mexico, and even with Europe is a zero-sum game that America has been losing. The only way America can win again, Trump seems to believe, is by slapping punitive tariffs on imports. His supporters don't realize that if the U.S. implements such protectionist policies, triggering trade wars and potentially military conflicts, their nation will be worse off. Americans and foreign governments alike have to make him realize the hazards of such a dangerous approach. Trump's abdication of leadership on international trade presents an opportunity for China, said Peter Harcher in the Sydney Morning Herald. Chinese President Xi Jinping has now seized the mantle of global free trade, presenting it as a win-win formula for all nations. On New Year's Day, while Trump was mocking my many enemies on Twitter, Xi was telling the planet, "We Chinese not only aspire for good living for ourselves, but also hope people in other parts of the world will lead a decent life." And last week at the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland, which Trump did not attend, Xi portrayed China as the new champion of multilateral trade pacts. There are already murmurs that China could join the 11-nation Trans-Pacific Partnership trade agreement, which Trump abandoned this week, in place of the U.S. "Why shouldn't China take over the baton from the U.S.?" asked Mai Xinyu in China Daily. China was the largest single contributor to world economic growth from 2011 to 2015, generating 41% of all growth in that period compared with 16% for the U.S. That shows that China's economy by itself is lubricating the development of the world economy. China has not sought leadership, to be sure. But as Foreign Ministry official Zhang Jun said last week, if it's necessary for China to play the role of leader, then China must take on this responsibility. "Still, we should be prepared for conflicts with the Trump administration," said the Global Times. "Bilateral discussions over trade are possible, even desirable. But Trump seems to think that sovereignty issues, such as the status of Taiwan or the South China Sea, can be negotiated away in a trade deal. They cannot. Does Trump not realize how dangerous his position is? The U.S. is not a united country now, and the authority of its current leadership is not guaranteed. Trump has plenty of enemies at home, and he is also making enemies across the world." And that brings us to the last word, our in-depth article, this week titled, "Trump's Path to Power." Donald Trump may be the most unusual president Americans have ever elected, said journalist Mark Fisher. Armed with a keen sense of branding and a fierce will to win, he loves to defy norms, expectations, and critics. From his picture window overlooking New York Central Park, Donald Trump could see the public ice rink that the city government had spent 6 years and $12 million trying and failing to repair. Most people saw the shuttered rink as a maddening waste of public dollars. Trump saw an opportunity to lead. In 1986, Trump, then a brash newcomer in New York real estate, offered to fix the rink in 6 months at his own expense. Trump's move was at once bold, magnanimous, and biting. In the same letter in which he made his offer to New York Mayor Ed Koch, Trump reminded the mayor that the incompetence the city had demonstrated in the rink project had to be one of the great embarrassments of your administration. Trump got the job done 2 months ahead of schedule and $800,000 under budget. The city paid for the work, but Trump slapped his name all over the place and generated months of adoring press. For decades to follow, the story of how he swooped in like Superman became a bedrock foundation of the Trump mythos. His carefully polished narrative of the billionaire who led by smashing through rules and expectations. The man who has now moved from his very own gilded skyscraper on Fifth Avenue to noticeably smaller and less lavish quarters in Northwest Washington is the most unusual leader Americans have ever elected to manage their nation. He is a salesman, not a diplomat, a master marketer, not a bureaucratic manager. He is an entrepreneur who has always thrived on controversy and confrontation, bucking up against the establishment types who often sneered at him. As president, Trump seems eager to lead in much the same ways as he has through four decades as frontman for his personal brand. Trump brings to Washington a leadership style built on his father's success in the rough-and-tumble world of developing apartment buildings in New York's outer boroughs, and refined under the tutelage of Roy Cohn, the infamous Manhattan lawyer who taught young Donald that all publicity is good publicity and that victory comes only to those who fight back 100 times harder than any hit they might absorb. Trump built a real estate empire that morphed into a casino gambling business, which largely failed, driving the struggling mogul to pivot into a period of leasing his name to all manner of luxury and not-so-fancy products. Through it all, Trump spent much of his time not on the finances of his initiatives or on their daily management, but rather on cultivating his own image as a playboy billionaire who was bluntly decisive, refreshingly impolitic, and singularly devoted to all things Trump. He rewarded loyalty. He called himself a loyalty freak, summarily sacked those who showed him up, and won fame and sometimes fortune as he put himself center stage in all his enterprises. The show is Trump, and it is sold-out performances everywhere, he said in 1990, soon after he appeared on the cover of Playboy. The show, Trump has often called himself a ratings machine, is very much at odds with the private nature of the man, a loner who says he has few, if any, close friends, an insomniac who often leaves social events as quickly as possible, returning to his apartment to watch TV by himself through the small hours of the night. In public, though, Trump is all business and all show, blending the two in ways that have now shattered the boundary between politics and celebrity. As he launched his career in real estate, Trump broke with his father, who had warned him against taking on debt or working in the tough market of Manhattan. Donald longed to reach for the next level and build in Midtown, and he did it by creating a business that looked bigger, bolder, and brasher than the competition. He led that business into the big time with tough, loud, showy tactics that he would hone through the decades. Trump led by creating an image of himself as a rich playboy with fabulous connections and by parlaying that image into actual deals with the city's rich and powerful. He led by making competitors, regulators, and bankers believe he was further along than he really was. And he led by neutralizing or even winning over his opponents by attacking, threatening, wooing, and even hiring them. During his very first project, the rehab of New York's decrepit Commodore Hotel in the mid-1970s, Trump persuaded a New York Times reporter to write about him as a major New York builder, though he had never built a thing and had no financing. Trump needed top New York politicians' cooperation to get his hotel project underway, And so he hired Governor Hugh Carey's chief fundraiser, who had key political connections. It didn't hurt that Trump and his father had donated more money to the governor's campaign than anyone but the candidate's brother. In the push for the same project, Trump sought a tax exemption from a state authority created to build racially integrated housing. The agency's chairman, Richard Ravitch, had grown up in the real estate business. Trump's father had hired Ravitch's father's construction firm to build the older Trump's largest apartment complex. Now Donald met with Ravitch and told him, as Ravitch recalled, "I want you to give me a tax exemption." Ravitch declined. Trump repeated the request, and when Ravitch declined again, Trump said, "I'm going to have you fired." Trump, in an interview last summer, denied that account and called Ravitch a highly overrated person. Trump wasn't done. When city politicians who were opposed to the tax incentive called a news conference outside the shuttered hotel, Trump showed up and threatened to abandon the project if the city didn't give him tax relief. Trump had prepared for the event by directing his workers to replace the clean boards over the once grand hotel's windows with dirty scrap wood, dramatizing the state of the Midtown eyesore. The theatrical flourish had the desired impact. Trump got the exemptions. For four decades, Trump led his business empire through triumphs and disasters, through domination of the Atlantic City casino world, and through six corporate bankruptcies, devoting his time and energies, perhaps above all, to his dealings with the news media. "The key to the way I promote is bravado," he wrote in his best-selling book, Trump, The Art of the Deal. "I play to people's fantasies. People may not always think big themselves, but they can still get very excited by those who do. That's why a little hyperbole never hurts. I call it truthful hyperbole. It's an innocent form of exaggeration and a very effective form of promotion." In business and in the 2016 campaign, he alternately bashed reporters and privately treated them to praise and access. "From a pure business point of view," he wrote, "the benefits of being written about have far outweighed the drawbacks. Even a critical story, which may be hurtful personally, can be very valuable to your business." His longtime construction executive, Barbara Ress, said, "Donald had a way of getting to print whatever he would say, even if it wasn't necessarily the whole and honest truth. He managed to say what he would say, and people would write it, and then it would be the truth. That was the thing with him that they call the big lie. You say something enough times, it becomes the truth." Trump has refined the art of working the levers of public opinion to pressure those who would block his initiatives. In 1985, after he bought the Mar-a-Lago estate in Palm Beach, Florida, Trump broke with the traditions of the wealthy enclave by chopping down his hedges to give gawkers a clear view of his castle, inviting a raft of celebrities and paparazzi, and opening the facility for wedding and event rentals. The town council, annoyed by the increased traffic and attention, tried to impose restrictions on street use and party attendance. Trump responded by sending council members classic movies about discrimination, Gentleman's Agreement about anti-Semitism, and Guess Who's Coming to Dinner about racism, to remind them and the public about how the town had long tolerated the exclusion of Jews and blacks from private clubs in Palm Beach. The effort to embarrass the politicians into easing restrictions on his club was successful. He recognized early on that his primary talent lay in marketing his brand more than in managing day-to-day operations. In 1988, when Jeffrey Breslow, the inventor of many successful board games, visited Trump to pitch him on a Monopoly-like game that would be named after him, the game developer was prepared to get down on the floor to demonstrate how Trump, the game, was played. But Trump had no interest in the details of the game. "I like it. What's next?" Trump said. And after the deal was negotiated, Trump volunteered to hold a press event at the plant where the product would be manufactured. His best value, he said, was in motivating the workers and winning media attention. Trump has always measured success by the reach and power of his reputation and image. All of his ventures in gambling, sports, TV, and politics were designed to spotlight the message that Trump means ambition, wealth, and success. He has always worked with a tiny inner circle of top executives. His campaign staff was about a tenth the size of Hillary Clinton's, remaining loyal to those who play by his rules. No one steps out on their own. All credit goes to the boss, and the message to the public is that Trump, the man, not the corporation or its other executives, is the rainmaker. If Trump believes an executive has done something behind his back, he pounces. You have to realize that people, sadly, are very vicious, he told an audience at a motivational seminar in 2005. When a person screws you, screw them back 15 times harder. He hires for loyalty, but also to build a staff that looks the part, a factor he has often mentioned through the years, including during this winter's transition, when he would comment to aides about whether job candidates presented themselves in ways that would convince a TV audience that they were right for the job. But Trump's method for picking people can also be more subtle. Throughout his career, he has hired people who had been obstacles to his projects, both to neutralize their opposition and take advantage of their knowledge. Trump also hires to create rival power centers. Many GOP leaders thought Trump would have to choose between Republican National Committee Chairman Reince Priebus and former Breitbart News Chairman Stephen Bannon to set the tone for the leadership of his White House. But Trump hired both men, the establishment choice and the rogue outsider, and gave them equal billing in his hiring announcement. When a group of tech executives visited with Trump in December, he told them, "You'll call my people, you'll call me, it doesn't make any difference. We have no formal chain of command around here." Building such uncertainty and unpredictability into his leadership and decision-making allows Trump to float possibilities, test ideas, and remain antagonistic to the powers that be, all before he puts a decision into play. Add his infamous lack of impulse control in his pre-dawn tweets, his thin-skinned reaction to criticism, his insulting comments about people he's already defeated, and a short attention span. He said he has no patience for reading reports or briefings, and the result is something not quite like any previous occupant of the White House. He scoffs at deep study and goes instead with his gut. He believes in his instincts. He believes he will naturally do the right thing. He believes, as he wrote in his book, Think Like a Billionaire, that a narcissist does not hear the naysayers. At the Trump Organization, I listen to people, but my vision is my vision. This was excerpted from an article that originally appeared in the Washington Post. And from there, we'll go right on to the talking points page. The Women's March, the progressive backlash against Trump. They came in tens of thousands, a teeming parade of pink hats brightening the gray Washington, D.C. sky, said Gia Tolentino in The New Yorker. There were sensible moms and crust punks, young dads carrying toddlers on their shoulders, and a great-grandmother who leaned on a walker, ambling gamely down the National Mall. This was the Women's March on Washington, held a day after President Donald Trump's January 20th inauguration, and it drew an estimated 500,000 participants. But the D.C. protest was just part of a huge wave, as 3.2 million people came out across the U.S. to send a message to Trump on his first full day in office, in perhaps the largest mass protest in U.S. history. Joined by participants in sister marches around the world, the protesters carried signs asserting their defiant dedication to women's equality, reproductive rights, affordable health care, Black Lives Matter, and more. The pussy grabs back, read one. Keep your tiny hands off my daughter's right, said another. The mass demonstrations, which dwarfed Trump's inauguration, weren't just a stinging rebuke of a man who has boasted of grabbing women's genitalia, said Charles M. Blow in the New York Times. They served as a message to Trump. You are on notice. America will not cower in the face of bigotry or Trump's vow to gut Planned Parenthood funding and dramatically restrict abortion rights. This was an uprising. This was a resistance. A resistance to what? Said Ed Morrissey in the New York Post. Trump just won a Democratic election. He'd barely settled into the White House when this resistance decided to pretend the loss of an election amounts to oppression and adopted the language of revolution. The left spent months lecturing Trump supporters on the importance of accepting election results. But now that American voters have elected Trump and Republican majorities in the House and Senate to undo the damage of 8 years of Barack Obama, liberals are having a violent temper tantrum. When will progressives ever learn, said Matt Lewis in the DailyBeast.com. They had an opportunity here to speak to a broad coalition of Americans concerned about President Trump's temperament and character, including the 53% of white women who voted for Trump. But pro-life women were disinvited from what was ostensibly a woman's parade, and marchers indulged themselves with expletive-laden attacks on Trump and tiresome pronunciation on the stage. A parade of pretentious and preachy celebs, including Ashley Judd and Madonna, delivered hysterical speeches comparing Trump to Hitler. It was all guaranteed to further alienate the working class Americans who put Trump in the White House and make never Trump conservatives like me wonder if maybe he is the lesser of two evils. Sorry, but Trump did not earn a honeymoon, said Steven Stromberg in the Washington Post. His inaugural speech doubled down on the divisive message of his campaign, with the new president ominously claiming to be the embodiment of the people and making it clear that anyone who doesn't accept his agenda won't be a loyal American. Protesting, though, isn't enough, said Edward Isaac Dover and Ilana Shore in Politico.com. If progressives continue to embrace a chaotic and disparate set of pet causes, from transgender rights to reducing mass incarceration, their resistance could fizzle out in a frustrated disarray the way Occupy Wall Street did. Instead, liberals should adopt the tactics of Republican Tea Partiers, who turned their 2009 protest into grassroots political organizations that propelled like-minded candidates into office, resulting in huge gains for Republicans in the 2010 midterms. Unless it leads to real political organizing, this week's march will mean little. The Women's March has already had an effect, said Jonathan Chait in NYMag.com. After Democrats lost the 2000 presidential election, it took them years to wake up from their late Clinton slumber. When they finally did, in the backlash that gave the party control of both the House and the Senate in the 2006 midterms, a lot of legislation had already passed. But now, one day into Trump's presidency, millions of Americans have declared they will not sit idly by as Republicans try to ram through a right-wing agenda and allow Trump to obliterate long-standing government norms. We're entering a new era, one in which the greater political passion and anger is on the Democratic side. Republicans had probably assumed the clock would not start for months on the liberal backlash. Now the clock is ticking already. Climate change, the hottest year on record. Well, it's official, said Phil Platt in Slate.com. 2016 was the hottest year ever recorded. NASA and the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration announced last week that the average global temperature last year was as much as 1.78 degrees Fahrenheit higher than the 20th century average, making 2016 the third consecutive year to break the global temperature record. With grim timing, the news broke just before the inauguration of President Trump, a man who famously dismissed global warming as a Chinese hoax. Almost every one of Trump's cabinet nominees, most notably Scott Pruitt, his pick to head up the Environmental Protection Agency, has expressed skepticism about the overwhelming scientific consensus that mankind's carbon emissions are driving climate change. Are we headed for disaster? Climate hysterics are making furious attempts to type up these numbers, said Robert Trzynski in TheFederalist.com. Both 2015 and 2016 were affected by El Niño, the Pacific Ocean weather pattern that produces a natural increase in temperature. What's more, the NOAA calculated that last year was just 0.07 degrees warmer than the year before, a tiny rise that's easily within the margin of error. There's no denying that the Earth's surface has warmed over the last century, said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial. But the warming is still not nearly as great as the climate change computer models have predicted. It shouldn't be the act of heresy to question the scale of climate change and to debate how best to address the issue. You have to ignore an awful lot of alarming evidence to remain a skeptic, said Jen Kirby in nymag.com. 16 of the 17 hottest years in history have taken place since 2000. Global sea ice at both poles is at its lowest level since records began. Combating climate change simply isn't something we can delay for a presidential term or two and catch up later, said Annie Sneed in ScientificAmerican.com. If Trump follows through on his campaign promise to cancel the landmark 2015 Paris Agreement, in which nearly 200 countries agreed to limit their emissions, it will undermine the entire agreement. If emissions targets are not met, humanity will face rising sea levels and more extreme weather, including prolonged droughts, devastating floods, and savage heat waves. There is little margin left between where the world is now and where it does not want to go. And we'll have to end it there today. We've run out of time for today's episode of the week. Be sure to listen again next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Fred Woodward. The Triangle Radio Reading Service would like to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of the week. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. The broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast on our website, TriangleReadingService.org. Questions or comments? Give us a call. 919-832-5138.